3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. Only double. Grab your hands.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Monday Breakfast Show here on Community Radio 3CR. It's Monday, the 1st of December, 2025. Where the other 11 months of the year have gone, I have no idea. I'm Rob. It's 7:01 a.m., just after 7:01 a.m. And for the next 90 minutes, you'll be listening to me and a few segments we have lined up for you. Before this, you were listening to a repeat of the Think Again show, hosted by the Borderlands Collectives. And yeah, for the next 90 minutes, as I was saying before, I'll be here bringing you some current affairs, as we do every Monday morning, and as the 3CR Breakfast cohort, the award-winning Breakfast cohort at 3CR does 6 days of the week. So to start off today, just after our news headlines, we'll be hearing a segment from a talk given by Tyson Yunkaporta back in September at Black Spark, talking about animism and reanimating the world. For those who are unaware, Tyson Yunkaporta is an academic, an arts critic, and a researcher who belongs to the Apalet clan in Far North Queensland. So he's also the author of the book Sand Talk, Right Story, Wrong Story, and Snake Talk. And so, yeah, we'll be playing a segment from that speech first up after our headlines in about 10 minutes or so. And following that, we will be joined by a delegate from the Australian Services Union, Emma Duke, who is the delegate for the members at Thorn Harbour Health, who are currently undertaking protected industrial action following 9 months of EBA negotiations with the healthcare organisation. I'm really excited to be speaking with Emma at 7:35 about that, to see what their demands are and how negotiations are going, especially after, 9 months of EBA negotiations. And then following that, just before 8 o'clock, it's the first Monday of the month, which means that our comrades at the Common Social Change Library have provided us with yet another iteration of their Tiny Sparks and Turning Points bulletin, which, listeners, if you haven't tuned in before or know what that is, the first Monday of every month at around 8 a.m., we play that bulletin, which basically lists, a bunch of radical events that have happened over the years that have changed the continent, especially, really important to know that radical events have happened and will continue to happen. I feel like if we don't do that, it can be very easily to become isolated, and to know that it's as I guess human rights become more and more radical, or perceived as radical or extreme, not just here in so-called Australia, but across the globe, I guess it's good to look back into history and to know that, we're not wrong for wanting people to have a house, to have their land back, or, people to be paid a living wage. that segment from the Common Social Change Library will be coming to us at around 8 a.m. or 7:55. And then the show is going to end with a segment, an interview with Peter Marshall of the United Firefighters Union. Yeah, we'll be talking about the calls that the union has been putting out about how much outdated equipment the firefighters across Circle Victoria have. And specifically with the opening of the Westgate Tunnel and the Metro Tunnels, you know, in a few weeks or soon. I drove past, I was, you know, in researching for this interview, I was driving past the Metro, the Westgate Tunnel, and all of the comms by the Allen government were saying, you know, the tunnel's going to open Sunday the 30th of November, and I don't know, maybe I missed something, but when I was driving past it this morning, it didn't look open to me, but, anyways, at 8:10, I'll be speaking with Peter Marshall about, yeah, their lack of equipment, or outdated equipment, rather, and, yeah, how the firefighters across the state have not had any specific tunnel training. Yeah, pretty alarming that, you know, if something were to happen in any of these new tunnels, that firefighters across the state would be essentially going in blind because they don't know the layout, they don't know the emergency procedures for the tunnels, and the equipment that they currently do have might not necessarily help them to, or might not necessarily make them fully able to do their job properly, which is, yeah, really distressing. Anyway, so that interview is happening at 8:10. And yeah, so for now, we will get into our new headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty. Now, one, two, nitty gritty. Now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on Community Radio 3CR, and these are the news headlines for Monday, the 1st of December, 2025. The Northern Territory's Acting Ombudsman has released their report into watch house conditions following a surge in the Territory's prison population with the introduction of the Territory's stronger bail laws. The Northern Territory has three watch houses designed to hold people for a short amount of time after they are arrested and while they wait for their court hearing. The acting ombudsman, Bronwyn Huck, found that the conditions within these watch houses were, quote, unreasonable and oppressive, end quote, and were, quote, ill-equipped to accommodate prisoners for anything more than a short stay, end quote. Huck observed severe overcrowding, people being required to use exposed toilets in cells with other occupants inside, as well as access to drinking water placed on top of those toilets, no time outside the cell or in the fresh air, and people's limited access to showers and facilities to brush their teeth. One image within the report shows some 17 people sleeping on mattresses on the floor of the same cell in full artificial lighting and mattresses being used as privacy screens next to the toilets. In response, the acting ombudsman has made 16 recommendations, including removing police officers from the territory's watchhouses as a, quote, matter of urgency, end quote. The full report can be read on the Northern Territory Ombudsman's website at ombudsman.nt.gov.au. Also in the news this week, the Inner Melbourne Community Legal Centre and the Police Accountability Project have released their response to the Victoria Police making the Melbourne CBD, the entirety of the Melbourne CBD and surrounds, a designated area until the end of May. If you aren't sure what that is, it basically means that from, at least in this case, from midnight last night until the 29th of May next year, the entirety of the Melbourne CBD, Docklands, South Bank, and parts of East Melbourne and South Melbourne will become an area where police can stop and search anyone they come across without needing a warrant, and yeah, just based on anyone they think they suspect could commit an offence. So the Police Accountability Project have said that there was no consultation with the community before this was introduced, and that the precedent for the scope, the geographic scope, and the length of time the designated area will be in place, there's been no justification as to why it's necessary, and of course there's been no consultation with the community that it affects before this was introduced. So research by Liberty Victoria found that only 1% of searches of this type yielded any prohibited items. All this, and the Police Accountability Project says that all this will do is increase distrust in the police by parts of our community, and of course it will exacerbate and perpetuate racial profiling. Of course Victoria Police have denied that they are doing racial profiling, but listeners of 3CR will know that the Centre Against Racial Profiling released some data, I believe last week or the week before, which shows that Aboriginal people and people of colour are up to 15 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people. And they are also more likely to be targeted, as well as, you know, people experiencing homelessness, young people and people with mental illness are more likely to be targeted as well. The Police Accountability Project have also said, you know, like anybody in these areas, the police will be able to physically search anyone without any evidence of wrongdoing. And, you know, people who have been randomly searched as part of these designated areas have described it as humiliating, intrusive, and an invasion of their privacy. And yeah, the only real option you have when they ask to search you is either you comply and get searched while, you know, oftentimes multiple police officers are standing around you, or you leave the area. And in this case, the area is the entirety of Melbourne CBD. Yeah, and if you don't comply, you could be charged with obstructing the police. So yeah, stay, you know, keep monitoring that. the Police Accountability Project and the Centre Against Racial Profiling and the Melbourne Activist Legal Service are really great in updating people when these designated areas are announced and, you know, where they'll be. Of course, I'm sure you'll hear more about it on 3CR. And before we get into our first segment, I just wanted to give a little shout out to all of the queer people listening. You know, this time of year is obviously really, really difficult for a lot of people for a lot of reasons. But over the weekend, I attended a Queermas, which is, for those unaware, it's a Christmas party for queer people and their chosen family. So it's, yeah, really beautiful. Obviously, it can be really, you know, you're navigating the beauty of being around community and people who respect you and see you for who you are, but you're also navigating the grief of yeah, not being to celebrate Christmas with people that, you know, oftentimes don't see you for who you are and potentially choose not to, you know. So there's it's a bit of a balanced situation. But anyway, I attended one over the weekend, and yeah, it was just a really beautiful reminder that, yeah, if this time of year is tough for you, for whatever reason, to, yeah, it's a good reminder to be with people that see you for who you are, and yeah, to feel okay about feeling grief together. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR. Stay tuned.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
It's the government's job to protect Australia's forests and oceans, but too often, governments put the interests of big corporations ahead of protecting your health, your climate, and your children's future. The Albanese government is about to change Australia's nature law. While this might seem like telling them how to suck eggs, we expect laws that actually protect nature by closing deforestation loopholes and protecting threatened species. It's literally their job. Head to wilderness.org.au/suckeggs to learn more. The Wilderness Society is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on Community Radio 3CR, 855 AM on the dial, or streaming live on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. And if you're out and about, hopefully you're staying warm and dry. But you can also be listening to 3CR when you're out and about on the Community Radio Plus app, which is a really beautiful way to listen to the radio. We will now be hearing a segment from a talk given by Tyson Yunkaporter back in December at Black Spark on animism and reanimating the world. Tyson Yunkaporter is an academic, an arts critic, and a researcher who belongs to the Abalesh clan in far north Queensland. He carves traditional tools and weapons and also works as a senior lecturer in Indigenous knowledges at Deakin University in Melbourne. He is the author of Sand Talk, Right Story, Wrong Story, and Snake Talk. Here's Tyson Yunkaporter.
Round two. Okay. So, Tyson, when I think of my relationship with you, what comes to mind is not thoughts or concepts, but rather sounds. The sound of an axe chipping away at a long piece of very hard desert acacia, or the shk 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 of rasping some clapsticks. A lot of what you offer in the written word is done so through the experience of carving, bringing pieces of dead wood back to life into song and story. Can you share with us a little what carving means for you and why you offer it as a container for transformative storytelling? You've even got a piece in your hand.
Yeah, that was. So I didn't make it clear that I wasn't just saying, "Oh, hold this for me for a minute." Like that's.
No, I'm.
That's what I made for you.
I know. All right,
I just seem.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to Fox later.
Okay, but you gotta keep it.
Okay, I'll keep it. I'll hold it. We'll explain this later.
Yeah. Well, it all comes around to the same thing, you know. Like everything that's good about, you know, what our law, what Yin was sharing before, everything that's good about that, and also the connections, you know, with runes, you know, law and recovered law, everything that's good about that is around good border work. Like we have indigenous border work is just human border work, like what most people have done forever, you know, and it should make people feel all right about diaspora. You know, we always think in terms of loss. Like I've been sitting here in Melbourne for 10 years thinking about what I've lost being 3,000 kilometers south, you know, from my family, from my clan, Upledge clan. And I'm just, I don't know, but it's been a gift, you know? Yeah, the things, diaspora is not, is not about loss. You know, you're carrying seed banks around, you know, of knowledge, and cultural recovery is just there for everybody. We don't know everything, you know, as black fellas, there's not, no single one of us knows everything. Each of us just knows a bit. It only means something when we come together, and sometimes we just couldn't be bothered learning any of it anyway, because we don't have to, because we've got law keepers who keep it. And like everybody in this room's got law keepers who keep their old law, keep their foundational law, you know. So when I talk about good border work, I'm talking about what we do when we travel, you know, when we use one of those three freedoms that every person has as their own sovereign law, is that you've got the freedom to refuse, to say, nah, fuck you, I'm not going to do it if anybody tries to force you. And then you've got that freedom of affiliation, you know, that you can, you know, connect up and belong to any family, any tribe who takes you in if you want to marry into that tribe or adopt in, they want to adopt you in. We've got that freedom of affiliation, and we have freedom of movement above all, you know, and we're supposed to voyage. Sorry, I'm looking at you the whole time. It's just anger. Not being creepy. See, that would be bad border work. yeah, because there's that, all those concentric circles of law. You've got that at that individual level, you know, your law as a self in relation. You know, that's, yeah, that's there. But then you're always in a family, and then that keeps scaling out. There's different law that comes out, you know, to your clan and then to your whole tribe, and then to your region, and then in the regions beyond that. And you have the right to travel. I mean, everybody travels. And we always travel, you know, when we're talking about law, we travel for ceremony, where we connect up with people, and we marry in with them, we have affairs with them, we have fights with them, you know, and but we meet at the borders. Because the idea of indigenous border work or border work in the global south has always been that it's a site of increase, it's a site of making kin, so kin making happens there. It's you know, it's a site of ritual, you know, where we, you know, we create and we make, you know, really fluid dynamic spaces of increase together, and kin making ritual, and it's about facilitating flows and norms of access. And that's how we regulate, that's how we do our border control, is by, you know, loving connections, making sure everybody's, you know, safe coming through. And that's it. And the same as the border between genders, you know, and you know, how we do that kind of crossover, and that border work's all good. But the border work is just fucked right now, like all over. And that's kind of coming to a head, and that's a crisis. Yeah, it's not just a meaning crisis or anything like that. It's bigger than that. It's that really invasive, not just defensive, but invasive border work What's comforting about it, though, is that... sorry, Brad, I'll finish up. What's comforting about what's happening now, like particularly, you know, the Trump world and just all the big blocks of dictators that are, you know, trying to get it up in all those places. What's comforting about that is it's always a sign of imminent collapse and fear of collapse when people start strengthening their walls, you know, and building walls where there weren't any before, making them higher, stronger. That's always a sign that they know it's falling. They know that, you know, and walls invite embellishment, you know. Like walls stop flows in nature, but also nature loves a wall. It's like, oh, there I can grow lichen there. I can grow some fungus there. I can put some spider webs there. The birds come in after spider webs, they're gonna shit, there'll be seeds in that shit and they sprout up. Soon there's vines all over it. There's graffiti, there's drug deals, there's people tunneling under it, you know, and soon it's just this beautiful thing that's, you know, nature finds a way. Yeah, because borders have a purpose. Borders are there to promote fecundity. They're places that we have to, like, we're drawn to those borders and to those others and to making kin. And, like, that's where the your black market economies start. At those borders there, and it's just it's inevitable, you know. We're gonna populate these places, and we're gonna come together. So we've been coming together for a good while around the Irish thing, and we've got people in Ireland, law keepers. We're sharing story with my beautiful partner Megan here. We just did a book about this, Snake Talk, and yeah, there's a big Irish chapter there, but the Irish influences all the way through because she's practically Irish. She's a borrowed woman from central Queensland, but her dad's Irish. And she might as well just be from County Cork at the time. Yeah, so, you know, so we set up these embassies. My lab mate and good brother Josh is here with his beautiful partner too. Yeah, we've been making embassy all over, setting up these sister labs in Canada with Anishinaabe mobs. You know, we got the embassy happening in Ireland that Holden there's been facilitating, along with others, you know, into South America, in the Amazon, you know, all over we've got these embassies going, and you can't ignore the global north.
Just tell us what the embassy is. What does it mean? What do you understand by embassy?
That's when I say border work. Embassy is like the ceremony, and it's the law that happens where your governance scales beyond your territory. We have common law in Australia, sunrise, sunset, you know, continental common law, and that governs our protocols of how we meet, our rituals of meeting and trading. So it's our economy when it goes beyond the local economy. And then sometimes he says, I'm genius, wait there.
Hello.
Sometimes he just does that. Yeah, the zombie thing originally was... It was more about a person who had like part of his spirit taken or a spirit taken, you know. So just soulless, missing something. But we all have that in our cultures. Every culture's got something like that. A description of why empathy disorders happen. You know, so my mob, we call it living ghosts. You know, someone just becomes a living ghost. They lose part of their spirit. And no one's born missing it, you know, they do the wrong thing, and, yeah, and they lose that part of their spirit, and they're hungry forever, you know, these living ghosts. Yeah, I don't want to reanimate them. That's just those narcissists that are around all the time, and they can't ever get enough, and that's the entire wealth class. And, you know, I don't think there's anything. I think the world's alive as a motherfucker. It's the world's fine. We need to, like, we don't need to reanimate that. It's always working. But then, you know, we need to deanimate the wealth class, probably. You know, I keep hearing about all this, you know, peaceful process. We've got to be non-violent, 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 non-violent. You know, we have law, and it's good. It's always designed to bring people back into proper relation. And you can even do it with those living ghost ones that can be looked after, you know. But if they keep raping and killing, doing the wrong thing, then, you know, usually then they'll end up with a spear in the leg or a spear in the shoulder. And the idea then is that, you know, it's not the spearing as a punishment, like, don't do it again. It's like, well, now you have to be looked after for a couple of months because you won't be able to get your own food, you know, so you got to lie down there and then we've got to look after you. And then they learn over a couple of months of, you know, what it is to be cared for and how important that is. And that, you know, one day someone's going to have to wipe their ass. Every one of us, you know. And so it might be nice for them to get around and wipe a few asses themselves and learn how to, you know, get that part of their soul back, their spirit. Then if they can't do it, though, we've got Death Spear. And the Death Spear, it's got, like, them chunks, you know, like crystal or volcanic glass or something. So when it goes in, doesn't matter where it hits you, you know, there's shards come off. I got one at home. I made one. I'm ready. But I wasn't there at the Camp Sovereignty at the right time, unfortunately. I did say, you know, you'd like try that. Try that anywhere north of Sydney, you know, you try that in Brisbane or Bundaberg or, you know, towns, we'll see what happens. Anyway, yeah, so we got this Death Spear, and yeah, that's just like, not finish, kill, finish. Sometimes that has to happen, it's not great, but, you know, it has to, because they take so much from everybody else that then they create living ghosts. They damage people so bad that they lose that part of their spirit. And then they start doing that to their kids, do that to other people. You know, it's just fucked. And, you know, yeah, it's a bit of a epidemic of that at the moment. But, you know, most people can come back. But I don't think anyone in the wealth class can. I just think it's time for a death spear and all of that. And, yeah.
Death spear and all of that.
I can't do it, though. I did it on my own one night after the referendum, and, yeah. And yeah, I'm on good behavior, you know, so I can't do it. That's gonna have to be somebody who doesn't have.
That was Tyson Yunkaporta speaking back in September at Black Spark about animism and reanimating the world. Tyson Yunkaporta is an academic, an art critic, and a researcher who belongs to the Abalesh clan in Far North Queensland. He carves traditional tools and weapons and also works as a senior lecturer in Indigenous knowledges at Deakin University in Melbourne. He is the author of the books Sand Talk, Right Story, Wrong Story, and Snake Talk. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. Stay tuned.
3CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our land.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
Life!
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on Community Radio 3CR. That song was, that very brief song was The Walls Are Closing In by Backhand, who I had the immense privilege to see on Friday night at an All Ages hardcore punk little mini festival in Frankston, which is so beautiful. Anyway, we are now joined on the line by Emma Duke, who is the an ASU delegate representing members at Thorn Harbour Health, who, as I said at the top of show, are currently undertaking protected industrial action following 9 months of EBA negotiations with the LGBTQI plus healthcare organisation. Good morning, Emma.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. Emma, do you want to start off by, telling us, how long have members been undertaking the industrial action?
Yeah, so like as you said, we've been bargaining for 9 months, but things weren't going anywhere. So we balloted for industrial action, protected industrial action. And that got a pretty overwhelming result. I think we got about 88% back on our vote to take industrial action. And that was back in October. And so we've been taking industrial action for a bit over a month now.
Wow. So maybe you want to tell us about workers' demands for the EBA.
Yeah, sure. So some of the key demands that we're fighting for include sector-leading gender affirmation leave, the right to work from home a few days a week, as well as cultural and ceremonial leave. There's a bunch of other conditions as well, but, those have really emerged as the key ones that members really care about. We just really feel that as a LGBTIQA health organisation and one that provides particularly gender-affirming care, Thorn Harbour should not only offer just good gender affirmation policies, but be leaders in that sector. And I think sort of similar goes for, the fact that Thorn Harbour hires, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, as well as people of colour, in roles where they're asked to draw on their particular identities and experiences. I think it's only fair that those workers are supported and compensated with a fair league policy for that as well.
Yeah. Maybe let's sort of just zoom in on some definitions a little bit. Maybe you just want to talk about what gender-affirming leave is.
Yeah, sure. So it's a pretty broad concept, I guess, but it's leave that an organisation can give for someone to affirm their gender in some way. So that can include things like, medical procedures and surgeries, but can include like a whole bunch of other things as well. Obviously, there's a whole legal framework around that. There's the sort of psychological impact of it. There's, all sorts of things that can be included in gender affirmation. And this is what members have said as well, that we really want to sort of not just focus on the medical aspect, even though obviously that can be, for some, like a large aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, as you said before, Thorn Harbour Health is the continent's oldest LGBTQI plus health and HIV AIDS organisation. Mm-hmm. What was members' reactions when management offered folks either 2 weeks per year or a one-off 30-day entitlement for gender-affirming leave?
Yeah, so, the first offer was the 30-day one-off. Maybe that was back in about April or something. Members really felt that wasn't enough. Like I was saying, gender affirmation is a process. It's not just one medical surgery or anything like that. So we rebuffed that offer back then. Then later management came back and said, okay, we can have either that or the 2 weeks, so 10 days per year. We all felt that wasn't enough either. As one of our members commented, 2 weeks off would barely cover the time it took for one nipple to heal after top surgery, for example. So, yeah, like neither of them are really enough. And I think people were pretty taken aback that, you know, a queer organisation is offering those things.
Yeah, and I guess, was it a similar situation with the cultural and ceremonial leave as well? I mean, their current offer was, what, like 3 days per year for First Nations people?
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And I think, our current demand is for 10 days. You know, so obviously that's ambitious, but yeah, we really feel that three is just not enough, especially when you include, you know, like, for example, travel to get to places on country and so on, and that sort of thing. And also the fact that it didn't, you know, obviously, of course, like Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are a key part of that, but also, other culturally and linguistically diverse people. We think should be included in that who don't celebrate, Anglo-Christian holidays and that sort of thing.
Yeah, wow. So talk to me a little bit. Obviously, you hinted at it a little bit before, but tell me how management at Thorn Harbour have sort of responded to the negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's been a long... Yeah, I mean, almost like, I guess, the full year of negotiating. I've been at most of the of those meetings. It's been pretty frustrating. Sort of just going around in circles. We have had some small successes. For example, we managed to get pay parity for our home care workers. It was a little bit complex, but basically everyone else in our current agreement is paid at 6% above award, except for the home care workers. They gave this whole complex explanation for why that was. But it wasn't really until we sort of raised it in negotiations that they actually fixed that up. So I think that was a real win. Around the other key demands, they haven't budged at all. That's been disappointing. There's been a few points at which, you know, they've accused us of bargaining bad faith. There was at one point where we tried to get members to wear badges that said work from homo in support of our work from home demand. True, that was technically unprotected industrial action, but, you know, for Christ's sake, it was wearing a badge. And then they sent this like pretty wild email out threatening all sorts of things, like including, I think, yeah, like suing and backing members and that sort of thing. So I think that's, yeah, we realised we had a bit of a fight on our hands to get what we needed.
And of course that led you to take your now protected industrial action. How has that really changed the way they are approaching these negotiations?
Some extent, yeah. Like we didn't hear from them for about a month, so we would just be like, oh, okay, what's going on? We did hear back from them, and yeah, they are sort of reconsidering some of the clauses, so I guess that's a good indication, that some of our action is actually having an impact. Amongst the delegates and members, I'm probably more of a cynic when it comes to these things. You know, like I'll believe things when I see them. So I'm sort of holding off hope a little bit, but yeah, at the same time, like a little bit hopeful, particularly when it comes to the work from home demand. I think they might come around on that. But I guess the other great thing that's come about since industrial action has just been like the activation of the membership. We've made this little industrial action committee called Gays Strike Back, and yeah, that's been this great kind of organising space. And members have really just come forward with great ideas and skills and energy. So yeah, that's been really good too.
It's really great that workers have really mobilised and gotten around that campaign, I guess. It can be really tough when members don't necessarily follow where the delegates sort of suggest or, you know.
That's okay. But I think, it can be a sort of, you know, like a matter of sort of convincing people, you know, about things. And I think sometimes it's just like the way, you know, just real life that has to convince people that, you know, like, oh, we actually do have to activate and that sort of thing to get what we want, as opposed to just ask politely, which I feel like we've been doing for a while.
Yeah, and do you think that members have sort of been, believing the management's point of view on why the EBA can't be better?
Yeah, look, I think there's a whole range, I guess. You know, I can't speak for the whole membership because, you know, there's obviously some members who think we should, you know, this is all silly and childish and we should stop and we've got enough. And then there's other members who, you know, I guess tend to sort of more agree with me that we should, you know, keep going and demand more. And there's a whole sort of range of that in between. But yeah, I guess like through the whole process, it's been a learning process for all of us about, you know, like at what point management are likely to sort of give in, where, you know, other points where they're not. And yeah, there's been a bit of a like ideological battle as well, I guess. Like, you know, they've sent around this all stuff email, like comparing our conditions with all the other sectors and that sort of thing. But, you know, we can do the same. Particularly when it comes to things like gender affirmation leave, I think. We're definitely lagging there.
Yeah. I'll just remind listeners that I'm currently on the line with Emma Duke, who is a delegate for the ASU representing members at Thorn Harbour Health, who are currently undertaking protected industrial action following 9 months of EBA negotiations, which have, I guess, turned stagnant, leading to the protected industrial action. So, Emma, maybe you'd like to tell us, what's next? What's happening this week in the campaign?
Yeah, so I guess we're continuing our action, mostly has been fairly low-key. I guess one of our sort of more successful actions has been just work-from-home days, because that is one of our key demands, and that's been very popular. We'll continue that as well as the sort of public-facing sides of things, I guess, you know, the posters and email signatures and the Insta stuff and that sort of thing. I think a few of us will also do some reporting there, which I think might get their attention a little bit more. But also we're also waiting to hear back. We gave them, I think, till Wednesday to come back about some of the key clauses. So we'll discuss with members, you know, once we hear back. If it's a no to those clauses, obviously there's one course of action. If there's a yes, there's another. It's a little bit up in the air. Definitely watch this space.
Yeah. And how can listeners and even potential like unionists who are listening help to support the action?
Yeah, sure. So you can follow us on Instagram. It's called Gay Strike Back. We also, in the link in bio there's a sign-on letter that you can sign on, and we're going to send that to the CEO. If you're, at any workplace, you can also print out little signs that say we support Gay Strike Back. There's also a link in our Insta bio to that, and take a solidarity photo. And we really love that. Yeah, we've really liked having the solidarity photos coming in.
Yeah, that sounds like a really beautiful way to show solidarity, especially like very public way to show solidarity. We can definitely put a link to both the Instagram page and the sign-on letter of support that you mentioned in the show notes for the podcast that we published for the show. We only have a few moments left, Emma. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, not really. No, I think that pretty much covers it. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. No worries. Thank you so much, Emma.
Yep, no worries. Catch you later.
That was Emma Duke, who is an ASU Australian Services Union delegate representing Thorn Harbour Health members who are currently undertaking protected industrial action after 9 months of EBA negotiations with the LGBTQIA+ healthcare organisation. Definitely check out their Instagram at Gays Strike Back, and you know, if you want to show some solidarity, take a photo of yourself with a little sign that you can print out and tag them on Instagram. Stay tuned to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR.
3CR, your station, your voice.
These weapons are pointed at all of us.
take it personally.
And we need to be standing with communities on the front lines and really amplifying their fight and their voices.
And fight this until Australia is no longer one of the leading weapons manufacturers.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Tune in to Right Relations and Innovations, 3CR's International Day of People with Disability broadcast, on 3rd of December, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Hear visions of a safe future for everyone and the relationships and innovations that can get us there. For details, visit 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2025.
G'day, Ralph Edwards here from the Concrete Gang, creatures of the industry, and a long-time supporter of 3CR. Next year, the Concrete Gang and 3CR are both going to be 50. 1976, and one of the first shows on 3CR was the Concrete Gang. We're looking for anyone who has some cassette recordings of a Concrete Gang show, anything from 1976 through to 2000 when everything became digitized. We're looking for that material. Whatever you've got, we're interested in getting them digitized and become part of an archive, which is the Concrete Gang 50th Anniversary Archive. Ring 3CR on 9419 8377 during business hours, or come in to 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, and help us put together the best possible archive we can have of the Concrete Gang. Dare to look, struggle to find, and help us out with the 50th Anniversary Archive of the Concrete Gang. Thank you. Keep our games and break a couple of concrete pours to back our log of claims.
Tune in to Stick Together, all about workers' rights and social justice.
8:30 a.m. Wednesday, 7 a.m. Saturday.
Or listen on demand on 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au.
Welcome. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on the dial. That song you just heard before those announcements was called One Way Out, from the great EP by a hardcore punk duo called DTA from Turtle Island. It's 7:55 a.m. on Monday the 1st of December. And given that it's the first Monday of December, we are, of course, now going to bring you a bulletin from our comrades at the Common Social Change Library called Tiny Sparks and Turning Points, which provides us a brief glimpse into some of the radical events that have happened over the years that have changed the continent. This feature is looking at the month of December over our collective history and, yeah, it comes to listeners on the first Monday of every month at 8 a.m. Here is Tiny Sparks and Turning Points from our comrades at the Social Change Library.
Tiny Sparks and Turning Points is a monthly selection of protests, strikes and significant dates concerning social change in Australian history. This segment is presented by the Commons Social Change Library, a repository of more than 1,500 resources for campaigners, which can be found at commonslibrary.org.
On the 1st of December 2002, a national weekend of action saw people rally around Australia against the impending second invasion of Iraq. Up to 10,000 gathered in Melbourne and Sydney, with thousands more in cities and towns across Australia, including Adelaide, Canberra, Darwin, Taree, Brisbane, Launceston, Ipswich, Alice Springs, Perth and Hobart.
On the 1st of December, but in Western Australia in 1984, the Cockburn Sound Women's Peace Camp was held for 2 weeks at Point Perrin, near the HMAS Stirling Naval Base. Situated on Garden Island, roughly 40 kilometres from Fremantle, the base had hosted 140 visits from potentially nuclear-powered and armed US warships since 1981, making it a nuclear target and posing radioactive hazards. 400 women travelled from across Australia to join another 600 at protests at the site against militarism and gendered violence, and for nuclear disarmament and Aboriginal sovereignty.
On the 1st of December 1972, 200 people demonstrated in Melbourne against the psychiatric repression of gays and lesbians.
On December the 2nd, 1916, 12 members of the Industrial Workers of the World were sentenced to between 5 and 15 years in jail on conspiracy and sedition charges. These related to their opposition to war and conscription, as well as their promotion of revolutionary industrial unionism.
In the early hours of the morning, on the 3rd of December 1854, troopers and police stormed Ballarat's Eureka Stockade, killing 22 miners and injuring many more. 13 of the rebels subsequently faced court on charges of high treason, but widespread public support saw all of them acquitted.
On the 3rd of December 2011, thousands of protesters in Sydney marched on the ALP National Conference to demand marriage equality for same-sex couples.
On December the 6th, 1966, Sydney gravediggers went on strike after one of their number was forced to return to work despite being chronically ill.
As part of events capping off International Women's Year, hundreds marched through Sydney on the 6th of December 1975, joining a national day of action to demand the repeal of all abortion laws, access to freely available and safe contraceptives, and an end to forced sterilisation.
On the 6th of December 1980, Santa Claus and others were arrested at a demonstration in Perth for defying Western Australia's 54B anti-protest laws. These made it an offence to convene public meetings of more than three people without police permission.
On the 7th of December 2001, sweat-free Santa and a crew of helpers unsuccessfully searched Melbourne department store David Jones for clothes bearing Fair Wear's No Sweat label, a union-backed guarantee that items had been produced by workers paid award wages under fair working conditions. After discussing their unfruitful hunt with retail workers and shoppers, the group then assembled outside the store to sing sweat-free carols to further highlight the exploitation of outworkers.
On the 7th of December 1973, high school students at Sunshine Technical School went on strike, demanding an end to chronic overcrowding.
On the 8th of December 1994, workers at the Adelaide Advertiser struck after News Limited refused to renew unionists' contracts.
Four members of Christians Against All Terrorism were arrested on December the 9th, 2005, after they entered the US-run Pine Gap spy base to hang protest banners and carry out a citizen's inspection in regards to the installation's involvement in violent activities. Despite receiving permission from the traditional owners of the land, they were all charged with trespass and damaging government property and served up to 2 weeks in jail after refusing to pay their fines.
During December 1979, anti-nuclear activists carried out a number of protests against plans by the South Australian government and European firm Urenco Sentek to build a uranium enrichment plant. This was to be situated near either Adelaide, Whyalla or Port Pirie. Protesters primarily opposed any widening of the state's involvement in the nuclear cycle on safety grounds, but also drew attention to the secretive nature of negotiations, Urenco's history of accidents at its British wind-scale nuclear plant, and the company's ties to military dictatorships. A cocktail party thrown by Urenco for government and business representatives was picketed on the 9th of December and a demonstration held in the city the following day.
On December the 10th, 1964, the Queensland government declared a state of emergency in an attempt to end the Mount Isa mines dispute. A wildcat strike led by rank-and-file unionists over wages and insanitary living and working conditions had begun in July of the same year and would last until April 1965.
Hundreds rallied outside Victorian Parliament on the 10th of December 2013 against plans to allocate up to 13 billion tonnes of brown coal for mining and export from the Latrobe Valley and Gippsland.
On the 10th of December, but in 1909, carpenters working on a new plant at the De Bavay Company's North Mine in Broken Hill walked off the job after three of their number were sacked for disobeying orders regarding when they could prepare and drink hot tea. Following the strike, the trio were quickly rehired and the matter of breaks resolved in the unionists' favour.
An Aboriginal deputation from Maloga Mission visited the New South Wales Premier on the 11th of December 1890 to demand land and independence.
On December 14th, 1982, protesters began blockading clearing and construction work in southwest Tasmania in what would be a successful bid to protect the Franklin River from being dammed.
On December the 15th, 1882, the first official trade union for women, the Tailoresses Union, was formed in Melbourne.
On the 16th of December 1929, coal miner Norman Brown was shot dead by police during picketing at the Rothbury Colliery. The industrial dispute had begun with employers cutting wages by 12.5% before locking out their workforce and bringing in strike breakers.
On December the 16th, 1938, members of the Australian Aboriginal League marched to the German consulate in Melbourne to deliver a petition condemning the, quote, cruel persecution of the Jewish people by the Nazi government.
On the 18th of December 1906, Victorian Socialist Party leader Tom Mann addressed a huge public meeting in Melbourne after serving 5 weeks in prison for defying attempts by the Prahran City Council and police to quash free speech. Having been denied permits, the socialists continued to hold street meetings, with the result that more than 20 members were fined or imprisoned.
After a refugee protested his handcuffing and involuntary removal from Australia, seven passengers aboard an Air China plane refused to take their seats on the 19th of December 2014. This action at Sydney Airport forced immigration officials to abandon the deportation process.
Despite heavy censorship and a government crackdown on protest, Australians voted in a second conscription referendum on the 20th of December 1917 to reject Prime Minister Billy Hughes' proposal to introduce enforced military service.
As part of a wave of squatting aimed at alleviating the post-war housing crisis, 15 adults and 20 children began occupying disused American Army huts in Brisbane's Victoria Park on December the 20th, 1946.
A long campaign for suffrage culminated on December the 21st, 1894, when South Australian women became the first in Australia to win the right to vote in state elections.
On December the 21st, 1934, teachers in Perth refused to prepare children for a military drill display to be held for the visiting Duke of Gloucester. This was one of the many industrial bans they placed that year in pursuit of better working conditions.
On the 22nd of December 1846, the Anti-Transportation Committee was formed in Sydney to agitate for an end to the convict system.
Three members of Sydney's Women for Survival group were arrested on the 23rd of December 1983 while painting an anti-war slogan on the side of the UK warship, the Invincible.
Convicts transported to Australia to perform unpaid labour for the colonial government, business people and landowners regularly attempted to improve their lot via various forms of work resistance. These ranged from carrying out tasks poorly through to losing tools and walking off the job. Disputes often occurred over the denial of public holidays. In 1830, 12 convicts at Stone Quarry refused to work on Christmas Day and were flogged for their efforts. In 1836, 5 convicts employed by Magistrate Benjamin Berthon similarly refused to carry out work on Christmas Day, but only received a reprimand.
On the 27th of December 1950, more than 200 Aboriginal workers in Darwin struck for a living wage.
On the 28th of December 1941, musicals in Sydney and Melbourne were forced to carry on minus dancers and chorus singers due to strikes carried out by members of Actors' Equity over poor pay and conditions.
On the 28th of December 1968, a conference bringing together members of Students for a Democratic Society from across Australia was held in Melbourne. During it, the draft resistance movement launched a national Don't Register campaign against conscription.
You've been listening to Tiny Sparks and Turning Points. The segment will return next month. In the meantime, to find out more about the history of social change in Australia, you can visit commonslibrary.org. The Common Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
Trans Family is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. Trans Family runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Trans Family are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. Trans Family is a 3CR supporter.
We are family. Get up, everybody, and sing.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on Community Radio 3CR. That song was Morning Rain by Adam Torres, a very fitting song considering the rain. The show is going to end with a couple of speeches from the Standing Together for Public Housing Forum. First up, we're going to hear from Kieran Stewart Asherton, who, of course, is a presenter of the Yellowman Show here on 3CR, as well as the Education Officer in the Executive Council of the Black People's Union, with a short presentation as part of the forum held on Thursday, the 23rd of October 2025, at the Capitol Theatre in the Melbourne CBD.
Wallawani Ninduan, Nayaga Kirin, Nayaga Din, Waniwandian. I hope you all had a safe journey here. My name is Kieran, and I'm a proud traditional owner from Waniwandian country in the occupied Yuin Nation. I'm also here on behalf of Rahu and the BPU. I want to start off by acknowledging and paying my respects to the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nations and to their elders past and present. This land, like all land across this vast continent, is unceded lands under an illegal colonial occupation. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This occupation presents a contradiction when we talk about public housing, and in fact, when we talk about practically all forms of housing and property. I want to mention here that I'm a firm supporter and believer in the right of housing for all people, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. But I must also acknowledge that housing and property rights has and continues to come at the expense of First Nations people. Our displacement, our dispossession, the concentration camp policies of the missions and reserves, our genocide and the occupation of our lands were the precursors for the modern day colonial state of Australia that we all reside in today, including the public housing that the colonial state of Victoria claims ownership over. This displacement from our homes and dispossession of our lands continues to this day, and it is evident in the stats. When we look at First Nations homelessness, we see that our people are over 8 times more likely to be homeless than our non-Indigenous counterparts. Alongside world-leading rates for incarceration and child removal, we also suffer from some of the world's highest rates of homelessness. Prior to colonisation, our people did not suffer from homelessness. Our people had strong kinship and cultural ties to their traditional homelands, and as a result, housing was accessible to us as food, water, and the air that we breathe. In an ideal world, First Nations sovereignty and self-determination would be empowered. The colonial occupation of Australia would be abolished, and we could once again return to a state that ensured housing not just for our people, but for all people who have come to call this land home. After all, when we speak of caring for country, we don't just mean the land and the waters, the plants and the animals, we mean the people too, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. Until we do live in that ideal world, until we see the fall of the colony, we must ensure that the most vulnerable within the community are looked after as best as we can. In this situation, it means putting aside that contradiction and pushing the colonial state of Victoria to stop its abolition of public housing and instead to invest in it, not to knock down public housing towers, but to build more public housing on our occupied lands. This push is especially crucial for First Nations people who are 5 times more likely to live in public housing than non-Indigenous people. We want to see housing for all. We must stand together and we must do whatever we can to ensure public housing is an accessible right for all. That means empowering and defending residents of housing towers who refuse to leave. That means supporting mutual aid campaigns that ensure families can access housing. That means lobbying, campaigning, protesting, direct action, whatever it is that is accessible to us to ensure that the Victorian state continues to build more public housing and doesn't demolish towers. Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. That was Kieran Stewart Asherton, host of the Yellowman Show here on 3CR, as well as the Education Officer in the Executive Council of the Black People's Union, speaking at the forum Standing Together for Public Housing, back in October of this year. We're going to continue with a few more little speeches from that same forum. Here is Margaret Kelly, former resident of the now demolished Barrack Beacon public housing estate in Port Melbourne.
Hi, everybody. So nice to see so many people interested in public housing. I want to talk about the devastating impact of forced relocation and top-down development at Barrack Beacon, not only on tenants but on the whole community. Forced relocation harms people. Without warning or consultation, the damage is worse. 12 days before Christmas, our community was told our homes would be demolished and relocation would start in 3 weeks. The staff went on break along with support services. People panicked. Some thought they could be evicted immediately if they didn't comply. Out of the 14 households in our courtyard, 2 people were hospitalised, one with a stroke, one with kidney failure. The process was rushed and unfair. Some got consideration, others, often the most vulnerable, didn't. 2 of my neighbours have died. Both cooperated but were repeatedly made unsuitable offers or told that their accepted home was no longer on the list while demolition went on around them. Both had been threatened with eviction. One died before moving after giving in from exhaustion. The other was forced to another suburb and died after 18 months of stress. If relocation didn't kill them, it certainly stole their peace. The government knew the risks. Their own research shows relocation causes harm. When actions knowingly shorten lives, what do we call that? The community believed government reassurance, even as plans were hidden until the demolition was complete. The consultation revealed 4-storey blocks built boundary to boundary with 10 and 12-storey tower blocks. People protested, but little changed, because it was under a state planning regulation. Trees meant to be preserved are gone. Homes along Barrack Road, part of a heritage listed area, now look out on concrete walls. 2 homeowners in that street have sold their homes because they are just worn out with the stress. It didn't have to be this way. There are alternatives to scorched earth development. We need planning that puts people first. Homes are about human lives, not profit. Thank you.
That was Margaret Kelly, former resident of the now demolished Barrack Beacon public housing estate in Port Melbourne, speaking at the forum Standing Together for Public Housing, which took place back in October of this year at the Capitol Theatre in Melbourne CBD. We're going to play just one more from that forum. This is Barry Berra, who is a North Melbourne public housing resident and lead plaintiff of the recent class action against Homes Victoria and founder of Young Australian People, speaking at the same forum.
Would you please welcome Barry Berry.
Hello, everybody. Hope you guys are doing well. I'm a resident at 33 Alfred Street. I've got 3 minutes left. So I'm going to be very quick. So I'm born and raised in North Melbourne and also in Flemington, one of the public housing. And then also I'm a leader, a community leader, a youth voice, a bit of everything. One of the things that the community is pretty much take lead into advocacy work in terms of crisis, in terms of emergency. The neighbours know each other very well. So for me, I grew up in North Melbourne where neighbours know me since I was a kid. And so everything, if anything happens to me, they know where I am in terms of emergency and things like that. In terms of relocation, we had a, you know, first thing, everybody heard it on TV, on news kind of thing. And then I had about 100 missed calls saying, what the hell is going on? We're in the same situation in COVID-19 as the lockdown. And so the community started to raise a lot of campaigns and a lot of community engagement with the government and also with the relocation team to have two sort of meetings kind of thing. And so the main purpose for that meeting was to tell relocation team, this is the way we do it, and this is the way we should be respectful and not leaving our home in the long term. So people have been there for almost 30 years, 40 years, living in North Melbourne at 33 Alfred Street, after generation, and this is our home. So yeah, so thank you very much for tonight. Thank you.
Tune in to Right Relations and Innovations, 3CR's International Day of People with Disability broadcast on 3rd of December, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Hear visions of a safe future for everyone and the relationships and innovations that can get us there. For details, visit 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2025.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. It is just before 8:29 a.m. on Monday, the 1st of December. We're just rounding out our show now, following those three speeches. I'll just do a quick recap of what we heard. We started the show with a talk given by Tyson Yonker Porter in September at Black Spark, speaking about animism and reanimating the world. Definitely check out his new book, Snake Talk. And following that, we spoke with Emma Duke, an ASU delegate, supporting members at Thorn Harbour Health who are currently taking protected industrial action. Definitely follow their Instagram at Gaze Strike Back and sign on the letter of support, which I'll put in the show notes. And we also heard some speeches from the Standing Together for Public Housing Forum, as well as our little bulletin from our friends at the Commons Social Change Library, Tiny Sparks and Turning Points. And with that, I'll see you next week. Stay tuned for Women on the Line.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.